Well, thanks all for coming to the workshop on this Saturday morning in this kind of maze of a campus here. I'm Evan Davis. I'm a freelance reporter with Pacifica Radio and also one of the co-founders of the Ohio-based voting rights group called the January 30th Coalition, J30 for short, one of the co-sponsors of this conference. I originally thought of doing this workshop in response to a number of things that I noticed as I was doing some earlier election protection kind of work after the election on November 4th, when we're all sort of reeling from the shock of the reported outcome and steeped in distrust as it was, I did a number of precinct surveys around Ohio where we went to different precincts and tried to actually speak directly with the voters to find out what happened on election day, and to research a number of anomalies which the reported vote tallies or the reported vote totals clued us into. And one of the first precincts that we went to was a working class, fairly well integrated precinct very close to where I live in Columbus, Ohio. And after speaking with fully 25% of the voters in that precinct, we found that 20.8% of the voters in that precinct had been actively disenfranchised. That means that they made some good faith effort to go to the polls and were turned away through any number of circumstances. The long lines, of course, that you've all heard of in Franklin County in particular were one of the biggest factors, but there were plenty of others too. Now, it was a heavily Democratic precinct. And some of the reasons why these people were not able to vote seemed to be deliberate on the part of the Board of Elections, like the misallocation of voting machines. But a lot of them were other factors, too, that didn't really have to do with the Board of Elections. There was the fact that it was a fairly poor neighborhood, and so a lot of people were working two or three jobs or had to work clear across town or had to rely on public transportation, et cetera. So getting to the polling place just under the best of circumstances was difficult for them, much more difficult than it was for me living no more than a linear mile from most of the addresses whose doors I knocked on. Childcare is an issue. A lot of people with poor health didn't have accommodations. The polling place itself was very inadequate. And this is by contrast to the polling places in other neighborhoods where there were an adequate number of machines and sufficient shelter and plenty of parking, and most of the people had an 8-hour job at best, if they worked at all, and had no difficulty getting there, and there were no lines. So that kind of sunk in, and as I was talking to the people who were denied their right to vote in this precinct, I noticed something about the way they felt about what happened to them. I noticed that it was really, really important to them to vote. And they were not only angry, but sad. I mean, some of them were in tears the moment I mentioned the purpose of our survey. They were just so raw about it. And that surprised me because as somebody coming from a fairly left perspective, I have very seldom ever voted for a winning candidate. I've almost never expected to vote for a winning candidate. My vote has always been a symbolic political act, therefore I've never ascribed much importance to it. But furthermore, I've never had any question about my ability to vote, and neither did my parents, and neither did my grandparents. Going back generations, voting rights was something that my family always took for granted. The people in this neighborhood, however, have faced these obstacles throughout their lives and throughout their parents' lives and as far back as they can remember. So voting rights to the people in this neighborhood were something that they remember as something that had to be fought for and something that was denied people in their immediate family and something that had historically been they had historically been deprived of. So their emotional attachment to this significant act of voting was far deeper than I ever anticipated, and that really touched me, and that drove my enthusiasm for the election protection work that I continue to do. After that fact, I felt like I had to represent these people in my neighborhood. And interestingly enough, that neighborhood used to be more directly part of my neighborhood until a freeway cut right through the area and divided the people I surveyed from the people that live in houses that look just like those houses on the streets that, you know, that are closer to my home. So there's a much deeper history, and it moves us to have to look at the issue of voter disenfranchisement in more than just technical terms. the election reform movement, as it is called, which has been predominantly a Caucasian affair, with few notable exceptions. But this movement has focused on the technologies of the voting machines. We've talked about legislation. We've talked about ways to, quote unquote, fix the problems to make elections fair and accountable and verifiable in the future. But whenever we talk about reform, that really doesn't resonate with the kind of people that I spoke to in that one particular precinct, because a lot of those people have heard that word reform before. Reform seems a wholly inadequate term to address the out-and-out violation of civil rights. And so it seemed to me maybe a little myopic, bordering on arrogant, for us to continue to talk about reform. So how do we define the difference then between equal opportunity, which the law as it is guarantees, and equal access? And access is a whole different beast. Access has to be defined in a way that includes economic, political, and social parity. We have to begin to address the obstacles that keep people from getting to the polls. And that's not just a question of them physically getting to the polls on election day. It's also a question of how people feel about the importance of their own personal vote, not just from a historical perspective of exercising a right that their ancestors fought for with their lives, but also being able to vote for a candidate that's truly going to represent them, that's truly going to take their interests to heart and legislate on their behalf. I don't think people have had that kind of inspiration for a very long time. I think most of the people who voted for Kerry voted for Kerry because he was the lesser of evils. They voted for him because they opposed Bush, because they're afraid of what would happen under a second Bush administration. Most of those fears have now been vindicated by what we've seen. But I don't think that Kerry really inspired that many people. It certainly wasn't the case in that precinct that I surveyed there. So when the predominant political parties continue to put forward wealthy, white, male, double-speaking candidates, as we have seen an endless succession of, that too is part of the disenfranchisement equation. So we need to develop an agenda, a social agenda, an economic agenda, a political agenda, of which voting rights, as defined in technical terms, is just one aspect. And I want to say something else about another precinct that I surveyed here in Cuyahoga County with Vicki Lovegren, who organized this conference, and Pat Lahoviak and several other people who are here. We saw some statistics about voter turnout in several precincts here in Cuyahoga County. And in some of these precincts, the voter turnout was just unbelievably low, less than 30% in some cases, 19% in one case. So we went to check that out. We went to go door to door in those precincts and find out who really voted, did they vote, were their votes just not recorded, why didn't they vote if they didn't. And what we found in the case of one precinct was that it was gone. There were no houses there. It had all been torn down. The only building there was a halfway house, and that probably had a lot of people coming through it on a monthly basis. Maybe a lot of them registered and used that address, but none of them were there anymore. And the second precinct that we went to, most of the houses were simply boarded up. Absentee landlords, urban blight, the whole thing. It's very believable that they had that low voter turnout. In the one that we actually went door-to-door in, the one that had about 35% voter turnout, it was far worse than the one in Franklin County. Many of the houses were boarded up. We had two or three families living in squalid apartments, doors that wouldn't lock, windows that wouldn't shut, broken down cars on the street in the driveways, you know, dangerous conditions, unhealthy conditions to live in. And these people, a lot of them were on public assistance or they worked two or three jobs. I mean, voting couldn't be high on the list of these people's priorities. It's just they had other necessities to attend to, and the conditions under which they were living were seriously impacted, you know, everything about their lives. And so it occurred to me that if we're concerned with votes not getting counted, it seems a little bit hypocritical to dwell on that when we have entire communities being uprooted, when we have people being displaced and disabused of their civil rights in all kinds of ways, that we need to expand and address that. So I think that that is probably the key to making this a more diverse movement, because as long as we are mostly white, mostly people of privilege, mostly talking about legislation and technical fixes, all we're going to be able to offer are topical solutions. and nothing that we build is going to be sustainable. We're never going to move more than a step beyond square one. So that's the thesis, and I want to introduce our panelists here. We have Deborah Calhoun with the American Friends Service Committee, who heads up the Africa program here in Ohio. We have Marsha Robinson, a history professor who's just beginning a tenured position at Otterbein College in Columbus. And we have Butch Wing from the Rainbow Push Coalition. We're going to talk about the history of voting rights in America as civil rights dating back to before the foundation of the country with the first federal democracy, which was founded by the first people of this country, the Iroquois, and relate this to class differences as to why people view voting rights differently coming from different perspectives. So with that, I'll pass the microphone to Marsha Robinson.
Thank you, Evan, and thank you, everyone, for showing up today. One of my jobs as a historian is to simply sweep through 5,000 years of history in 10 minutes and let you have enjoyed the trip without getting off the bus. What I'll do quickly is introduce to you the concepts of democracy as practiced before the United States. One concept that we've talked about is the Iroquois Federation, in which there could be a council of men who would take care of intertribal affairs, but it was women who made the decision on whether or not we will go to war. It was women who made the decisions on whether or not there would be an allocation of resources. A similar pattern of male-female relationships in power occurs in North Africa among the Berber peoples, in which the men there also handle intertribal or inter-community affairs, but it's the women who own the land and the women who own the production of food. No one can make a decision without consensus between the two genders. If we skip to the 1500s in Poland, there is a federation of baronies and small feudal estates. In this federation, they would come together for the purposes of mutual self-defense. It was a social contract, a way of creating peace against invading peoples. This kind of mutualism that we will create a space of safety also occurs in the United States. It occurred when we decided that we needed to have some sort of protection against the French incursions coming down the Mississippi Valley, against the Spanish incursions coming in from the lower Mississippi, New Orleans port, from Florida heading north, from the British and the French attacking from Canada into the first original 13 colonies, and still how do we make room to deal with the internal population of Native Americans and yet expand? What came across with the founding of the United States and the search through the Enlightenment for ideas from Rousseau, et cetera, is not the idea of democracy, which we've been taught in elementary school, but actually the formation of a republic. And I want to talk about this as Plato's republic, in that there are people with souls of gold who are worth ruling, and there are people with souls of clay who aren't worth the time of day. And this concept of class difference is very much embedded in the formation of the United States Constitution. There was never any intent for all white people or all black people or all red people or all brown people to vote. They were never considered worthy enough when the Constitution was first founded. Even the revisions that came through, when George Washington was elected president, only 6% of the population voted. Only 6%. There were property requirements. Now, there was a rationale behind this property requirement, which I kind of agree with. If you're going to vote, you better stick around long enough to live with the consequences of your decision. And that was the purpose of having the voting requirement for land. You have to have enough of a vested interest in the community to say that I will make this decision and I will go with the way the group decides because I have to live with the consequences. Unfortunately, that valid point was muted into vagrancy requirements and property requirements and poll taxes. For example, in Alabama, when there was a decision on how do we decide who gets to vote after the Civil War, well, you had to have 2 years residency in the same county. You had to be employed for the better part of the prior year, and you had to have a certain amount of property. You had to be in that precinct 3 months prior to the election. Well, that sounds fine, but then they had these clauses about you have to be literate. Now, the literacy clause that I heard about was usually directed against African Americans, and it was taught to me as a way of depriving African Americans of the vote. The literacy requirement was modeled after a program from the state of Massachusetts to require English language literacy to disenfranchise recent immigrants. Many of the programs in the South that were used to disfranchise African Americans were modeled on programs from the North. What the North wanted to do to limit the vote for recent immigrants, the South applied to eliminate the vote from African Americans, but in actuality from poor whites as well. In fact, more poor whites were disfranchised in this country in 1942 in the following states than African Americans, and I'll give you some numbers. This is 1942, the year that everybody goes off to war, you know. Great summer from the movies, from what I understand. In the states of Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Mississippi, South Carolina, Texas, and Virginia, in 1942, there were 4.07 disfranchised African Americans. There were 6.8 million disfranchised white Americans. These people who were disfranchised, whether it was because they could not prove that they had an ancestor who fought in the American Revolution, the Civil War, or any of the American wars, where they could not prove that they had good character or they did not meet the residency requirement, these people were consciously and purposely disfranchised, and they knew it. Now, in going back for a background on Ohio and voting machines, I found out in 1912 that we failed an amendment to pass acceptable voting machines in Ohio. Ohio's been fighting about voting machines since 1912. It's nothing new, and we still haven't gotten it right. But in looking around that time period, I found some language that I think we need to talk about in order to free inter-ethnic cooperation for this voting reform issue. One of the things that I found was taken from an article from Political Science Quarterly, a very academic journal, 1905. And it stated that this whole disfranchised movement was designed around the following question: how to get rid of the venal and ignorant among white men as voters was a far more serious and difficult problem than how to get rid of the undesirable among Negro voters. I don't think people are admitting that all of their grandparents could not vote. It must be a secret that we don't talk about. And I think it's creating a lot of pressure. Now, another vote that I found, quote that I found, was in the 1890s and 1880s. There was this populist movement, you know, give power to the farmers in the South. It was a trans-ethnic populism movement, mostly active in the American West and in the American South. But in the South, in the Piedmont and Appalachia, the populist movement was approved of by poor whites who hated the bourbon or the elite population, because the poor whites knew that the literacy and the poll taxes, as test, were designed to disenfranchise poor whites. People at the time knew that. Poll taxes. In order to qualify to vote, the justification for poll taxes was, if we pay this poll tax, we'll use the funds to fund the public school systems. And this was how money was raised, so that everyone could pay a tax to fund public schools. It's a very good idea. But you had to pay your tax in Tennessee in February and hang on to your receipt until November. Okay? Chances of possibly losing it are great. And if you did lose it, well, you paid your tax, but you're disfranchised, regardless of your skin color. If we look at Ohio, Ohio kept the word that the franchise is open to all free white men aged 21 and over well past 1912, because they knew the 15th Amendment overrode it. But as of 1912, no one wanted to remove the word white from the Ohio Constitution. I'm bringing this topic up because I was rather shocked to find out that what I thought in the 1960s was a movement to liberate African Americans was actually a movement to liberate all Americans into a democracy, so that by 1966, the feudal system of America died. And I'm going to say we were feudal until 1966 because poor whites voted by the permission of the elite. If you had their permission, all of these requirements at the polls could be waived by the local poll judge. And I think we need to talk about that more, that the United States did not become the model of democracy until the 1966 decision of Harper versus the Virginia State Board of Electors. It's Harper versus the Virginia State Board of Electors. In that decision, the justices ruled that the poll taxes violate the 15th Amendment by restricting access to the vote. And I have to remind you, the 15th Amendment was passed to allow African Americans to vote. Another decision that was made based out of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments was Plyler versus Doe, P-L-Y-L-E-R versus Doe, D-O-E, of 1982. And under this decision, it was established that children of illegal Mexican-American immigrants can go to school in the state of Texas. And they are protected because they are protected under the clause of territory in the 15th Amendment. One of my favorite decisions from this time period around the 1912s that I looked at comes from Justice Frankfurter in Guinn, G-U-I-N-N, versus United States, in which Justice Frankfurter says that the 15th Amendment nullifies sophisticated as well as simple-minded modes of discrimination. Instead of having poll taxes, I think what we have are real estate prices. If you have the correct property value in your precinct, you can vote. If your precinct doesn't have a high enough property value, you're not worth the effort. And if that's not a sophisticated hidden poll tax, I don't know what is. It hasn't gone away. And that kind of a poll tax discriminates by class, by economics, not by color. If we are to actually override these discriminatory practices, we must do so as a polyethnic population, a polyethnic group that's going to demand that the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments be enforced. I know we're having discussions later on today about changing the Ohio Constitution. The Constitution is good. As Gerald Ford said after he was installed as president when Mr. Nixon left, he said the Constitution does work. The question is, how do we as the population make people in office recognize that they are our servants and our employees? How do we put the pressure on them to make the existing laws work? And I think that's where movements like today are very crucial. We have to learn how to use the existing system the way it is. I mean, the rest of the world models themselves after us. And yet in the United States, we still lean toward the republic. Now, the republic means that only a few are qualified to vote and that they're supposed to look out for the interest of the others. In the old terms of the 19th century, this was called noblesse oblige, or the obligation of the nobility. We don't have that noble sense anymore. That's been gone since the 1960s. We've now moved to what William Galston calls in his 2005 book, The Practice of Liberal Pluralism. We've moved to a concept of civic totalism. Civic totalism is the idea that the power is invested in the sovereign, or the power in this case would be invested in the president. It cannot be divided and it cannot be questioned. It requires a worship of the leader, something we used to call during the Cold War the cult of personality, something we thought was evil about Lenin, something that was evil about Stalin, that they worshiped their leader. And yet, since 1968, we have been, in Republican administrations, required to worship the leader, to establish all kinds of monuments to the leader's name. But the leader is not, in turn, the servant of the people. And that's what we have to change. We must, if we're going to be a democracy, as made possible by the 1966 decision of Harper versus Virginia, State Board of Elections, if we are to be a democracy, we must make the leaders of this country our servants, and we must recall them, and we must impeach them quickly. We could have done an impeachment last summer. I went on record in the State House that we should have impeached Mr. Blackwell for violating Article 2 of the Ohio Constitution. All ballots must be recountable in close measures. The Diebold machines that were originally presented, the DREs, I had a chance to look at them last April, did not have the ability to recount. They had the ability to reprint. And a reprinted document is not a recounted document. I also spoke to one of the Diebold representatives, and he said, well, of course we can make machines that work like this if the state asks us to. And they could have had it ready. Australia had a machine system ready in 6 months. It could have been ready for the last election, but the state did not pressure them to do so. It's not Diebold's fault. It's the fault of we the people. And we don't need to take the jobs away from our local friends and neighbors who work at Diebold. We just need to make sure that the government gives the correct prerequisites when we do out the request for proposal. And that's our responsibility, to make noise, to enforce the government, and to make sure that the government works for we, the people. And the only way I think we're going to do that is if we start a process of talking to disfranchised white people, getting their oral histories, getting them on a blog, doing whatever it takes. But let's take away this secret that white people have always had the vote. It's a lie. And it's a lie that keeps us separated, just as it did during the IWW days, when white workers in a lumber town would get wonderful flowers around their cabins and the breeze would flow through the closed doors of the black cabins. We need to eliminate that myth of universal white franchise from the Jacksonian democracy days. It never existed. It's a lie. And the power is in the truth of saying we did not have universal franchise in this country until 1966. And now I'll turn it over to people who can say what we've done with it since then.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Marcia. That was really good. It's good to see another historian in the room. When I was in graduate school, we had the joke that historians read other people's mail. Yes. And that's basically what we do as we try to do those theses and try to do those myriad of papers and things. So it's always good to have that historical backdrop and context. And I also will plug a little of what I do at Kent State University, where I'm teaching a class on Black Experience One. And the joke in my class is that we go through in part one 6.5 million years of history in 16 weeks. Mm-hmm. And if you leave the room, you'll miss three centuries. So my students have learned that I'm the queen of handouts. But, you know, in these survey courses, it's just the bird's eye flyby, which is good because they're there because they want to learn. And I think it's in that context I want to try to suggest my comments today. And because one thing that's unique, I think, and maybe it's not, about my classes at Kent State is that even though it's in the Department of Pan-African Studies, and I was 10 years at Kent Main Campus, and I've been about 3 years or so at the Stark Branch, I think I can say 75% of my students were white. Maybe 25%, maybe 10%, depending on the semester and how bad the previous winter was. Were students of color. And I only say that point because it really reflects, I mean, some of the things that Marcia mentioned really talks about our real lack of knowledge about the other side. I have two quick stories before I start some of my comments this morning. First, one of my students named Ethan. He was a nice kid, got an A in the class, really was a good kid. He dreaded his hair, and he was a white student. And so I remember talking about his locks and, you know, how hard it is to kind of, you know, get straighter hair to lock. And he said, yeah, it took me a while, but it finally started working for itself. And I remember near the end of the term, after he had finished his final, I said, well, what are you going to do? I'm going to go to Massillon or Mansfield, cut my hair, and get a job. And so I thought about it, and I said, oh, that's interesting. Why do you think you have to cut your hair? Well, you know, I'm in conservative Mansfield, and there's no way I can get a job in my little suburban secluded community if I had this hair. And I said, well, you have to think really why you did it in the first place. Was it just a fashion statement? Was it just a fad? Or were you really trying to connect and make a real statement and an impact with yourself and your life? And I mentioned also that people of color and people who are on the other side of the fence can't cut their hair. They can't change their clothes and be different. Because when you look and see me, you see a black woman. I can't hide it. I can put on as many blue contacts as I can buy and, you know, get as much hair as Beyonce, and it's just not gonna work. I'll never be a size 6. I'll be a 16 or a 26 or a 36. And I'll never be blonde unless, you know, Lady Clairol speaks to me. But my point only is that we can't change as flippant as one would cut one's hair, and that you have to really think about, you know, what you do and why you do it, and stick to your guns and be principled about it. My other quick story, in my work with the American Friends Service Committee, I get all stripes that come into our office, and I had someone I think from our mailing list had come into the office one day, and he was you know, Greg wasn't there, and so I said, well, yeah, I got a free ear, you know, what's up? And so he commences to tell me about this uncle he has in his family who says derogatory things at the dinner table. And pick a ethnic group, he's got a name for it. And so I said, well, oh, that's pretty bad. What do you do when your uncle says these things? You know, we're at the dinner table and we all kind of get that pregnant moment where it's just, oh God, you know, what are you going to say to this guy? But nobody says nothing to stop this wild uncle from running amok at the dinner table, conversation-wise. And I said, well, why didn't you say something to him? I said, you're his nephew. You have a better chance of influencing that uncle across the dinner table than I would, or some of my cohorts standing in front of his place of business, picketing him for whatever worker he's choosing to dismiss for whatever reason. And I remember also just saying to him that we have to take these opportunities where they present ourselves. And, you know, we can't excuse it by saying, well, he's paying my tuition at the university, or he's giving me money for books. I said, no, cut, back up, back the tape up. Now, if you were in any other kind of situation in the public realm and you heard those kind of comments, you'd quickly step on that situation or use that as an opportunity to stop that person, back them up, and try to educate them as you try to correct them. And we have to do the same thing in those kind of relationships, especially with family. Your nephew, we come over to your house every Sunday to eat. You know, there's this family thing working where your guard is down and you're open to new information. And I find that's the biggest thing I see as a, you know, history professor, as a activist in my Akron community. We have all these excuses for why we can't stop that attitude from getting loose and amongst us. And I think I'm arguing, and I'm only using these two stories to say that we have to take these opportunities and really fundamentally ask ourselves, what kind of country do we want this to be? Do we want to be led by, you know, those of a particular stripe that think history is only in their realm and world and the rest of us don't matter? Or do you want to take a people's bottom-up view of it and really take the responsibility to affect change for the positive? So the elections of 2004 and even of 2000 provides us with an opportunity to get it right. I know students that said they won't vote again. They said, well, I've been burnt twice. And it's just like that kid, any of us who have children, you know, that baby, when they touch a stove, usually only takes one time for them to say, oh, hot. They learn that before they learn mama and daddy, yeah? Because they know what that being hurt feels like, and they don't want to be hurt. So kids are pretty smart in that kind of way, and I think we should be, too. And I guess no students that easily say that they won't vote again. I've been burnt twice. Why should I play and sit at this card game a third time? Knowing that the table's crooked, there's some cards missing, and you want me to sit here and, you know, try to play as best I can and hope I don't lose too much money. Insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting the same or different result, you know. We can't expect and we can't throw away opportunities at organizing so flippantly. So for me, 2004 was like 2000. Florida was Ohio, Ohio was Florida. It just changed geography. Rather than the southern east part of the country being the focal point, the Midwest was the focal point. And I know at our office, it was like a funeral the next day. It's like somebody died. What happened? We lost the election. And? Because I remember having an argument with some folks at work over this question of, you know, what happened. And I said, well, the Democrats didn't work hard enough. 51-49%, that's too close. If you're going to get out here and work for change, you need to make it decisive, 60-40, 70-30. They talk about mandates and ways to make change. That's a decisive victory. And there was enough Democrats and enough folks and enough reasons why not to elect Bush that were out there that just was not capitalized on. So in the people's minds, at least in mine even, okay, I'm going to get maybe $10 more food stamps with this guy and another one's going to cut him out. I'm getting food stamps. I'm working a job at $6 an hour and I got a family. You know, those are the kind of realities that a lot of people in this country are really living and dealing with. I mean, I know folks who are waitresses and they are working a second job part-time when they're not waitressing. I know one woman that has three part-time jobs, you know, on different days of the week to kind of balance it with family and things like that. So when you deal with these kind of structural economic issues, I think we have to go to the core of it. And that means it's going to get ugly, it's going to get nasty, it's going to get dirty. But, you know, people who have lived on the other side of the line, those who are of color, those who are poor, those who are of different statuses and strata in life have been dealing with it all the time, so it's nothing new for us. It's really nothing new. And I think what I'm saying is that this larger issue means that we can't try to fix, as we try to fix it, and there may be some things that are salvageable, but we also must have a paradigm shift in how we think and how we work and how we act and interact with other people, other activists, other communities, because I think we can't be so arrogant to say that only, you know, middle class suburban America is going to do it. They're going to be the last on the boat. It's going to be everybody else who's working and moving it. And then I said, oh, we've missed the opportunity. We had to run, catch the SUV before it turns a corner, you know. So I'm only saying that I think that we have to work with allies. We have to form relationships. We have to form connections with other people, especially those who have been on the brunt end of this for the longest of time. And I think too many times in terms of our education piece, which is why I mentioned the numbers of my students in terms of my class, we don't seek out the unknown information enough. And thankfully, enough students are that they can say, well, oh, I didn't think about, you know, something past Greece and Rome. You talked about the Republic. Akron U has this lovely course called Western Civilization and Culture. It is 12 hours of hell. But there's no class required for African history or Eastern Civ or a Chinese history or Asian history or Latina history. None of that is required, but we make us go through 12 hours of Western cult. So I remember the Republic and Plato really probably too well. So to try to quickly go through my short, just some list of some things as I was thinking, talking with Evan over the phone and over email, we've been flashing words back and forth, some things that kind of came to mind to me as I thought about what to try to suggest and talk about today. I'm not worried, first of all, I guess, what Europeans say to me, because they've learned to be very tactful and polite. And they know you can't say certain things because, you know, that Deborah, she'll, that hair on her neck start rising and then it's going to be on. So they can be very diplomatic and very quiet. And but I'm worried about what's done behind the scenes. I'm worried about the machinery being at play and at work that keeps people from the franchised process. I think to an extent in that realm, we need to also understand what role nationalism is going to play in all of this. Every nationality must come to terms with its history and culture, both the good stuff as well as the bad stuff. I remember Dr. Du Bois talked about this thing of this duality, wearing two masks, going to work and being of one mind, but when I come home, I can get out this clothes, I can put on a pair of sneaks and be myself, you know. Take my hair out, which is really kind of scary, but, you know, I do that at home so I don't hurt too many people. But he talks about this question of duality. And often when we talk about integration in this context and country, it's been at the loss of your cultural self, where you got to change and go through whatever just to fit in. And some of that is changing. If we look at even how the media and those media personalities are out there now, you're seeing dreads on TV. You're seeing braids on TV. You never used to see that. 10 years ago, I took my employer to court over whether I could wear cornrows at work. Now, they were neat. I worked in a restaurant. Off my face, none in the food. In fact, no black hair was ever in any food in the restaurant. But every now and then you found plenty of blonde hair in Sabella, who was a lovely German lady who worked the kitchen. And, you know, my point only is that I had to take my employer to work or to court just for the right to wear braids at work. So this is kind of new. And we're seeing some of it break. We're seeing dreads now. We're seeing brothers with dreads and with the full wraps. If you watch MTV and some of those stations, we see bits and pieces of it coming. If we see the news, we see some of that coming. So this pressure to blend in hurts the cultural self. So I'm only saying that to a certain extent, nationalism is needed. So we shouldn't get scared if we see, why are all the black kids sitting at the lunch table? Maybe because it's a refuge. And it's a time to decompress before you go back out there to battle again, because education is one of the ways where I see a lot of public education, because that's where I'm from and my kids go to public school, et cetera. That's where I see a lot of struggle taking place, where you're learning in a community sense the whole contributions of Egypt. We're talking about history before Greece and Rome, which means you're talking about 10,000, 15,000 years of history before anybody knew who the heck Rome was and where it was and who are the people and players and actors. But in the classroom, you're getting the Republic in Greece and Rome. So when you talk about Hatshepsut or Imhotep or Amenhotep and Memphis and some of these ancient, and Nubia and some of these ancient cities and places, the teachers are looking at these kids like they're crazy. We didn't talk about that in the lecture. It must be the wrong answer. So we need to open up and begin to think that groups are going to come together and going to have their aspects and bits of nationalism. And I think in that realm, to me, even internationalism means nations interacting. So if a strong black community, a strong Latina community, a strong Mexican community, a strong Japanese community is going to be a stronger community and a stronger ally. So when we come together, we come as equals to the table. And not, oh, well, we're going to make a seat for you, and we're going to make a seat for you, and accommodate and fudge and twix it. But we all are coming and standing on our own, and we can better move and work forward together. So that shouldn't be scary to me. And I've already mentioned this whole point of learning the culture and history of the group that's not of yours. I have to work up on my native history. I know I have to work up on my Japanese and Chinese history and their contributions to world civilization, because that's my weak point right now, and I got to work on doing that deliberately. Relearn who we identify as sheroes and heroes. Why don't we know as much about Alice Paul and Lucy Stone as we do Elizabeth Cady Stanton? Why don't we know more about the Grimke sisters? Why don't we know more about Ida B. Wells? Why don't we know more about the real role of the Buffalo Soldiers? So there's animosity. You know, when I see Native Buffalo Soldiers, they look good, and I know some folks who do reenactment, but I'm torn because they were used to strip the West of indigenous people. So this, you got to kind of almost look at, you know, the lie in Columbus in 1492, but understand there were natives here who weren't lost, and they knew where they were. How come Columbus didn't know where he was? So there's always this different question of how to analyze the history, historical context as you get an opportunity. Acquire analytical skills. I mean, this power of argumentation means we have to stretch outside the borders of who we think are our theoreticians and philosophers to look at. We gotta look at Freire. We gotta look at Lenin. We have to look at Nkrumah. We have to look at Mao Zedong. We have to look at all of the other contributions. Chief Joseph, all these folks that brought information and knowledge to the table, we just don't get them in our books, but we can find and relive and reshape that. And in fact, I would say expand it even past Marx, because Marx did not foresee the emergence of Africa in his work. Remember, he talked about the white working class is going to organize and get their stuff together and rise up. Didn't happen, because they were bought off with benefits and fudging and fixing the workplace and the society so that they wouldn't be so angry at being hungry while they're working. But Africa was the one that put this stuff on the table and really made it for us to kind of really think of and look. We need to organize our communities. And I'm not saying we should do it together at some point. I'm saying we need to do it both, separately and together. Where if you're a stay-at-home mom and there's some other moms you're working with, why not organize study tables and study salons and study some of these theoreticians? Because that's the best way to learn. Socrates talked about the question and answer, the dialectic, the discussion. That's where you really learn, not just, you know, stuck in a library somewhere reading it, which is good and you should do it, but we need a way to kind of bounce things off each other collectively. You know, it's hard and dirty work. You know, it's nothing easy. There's no magic pill. It's grudging, because I've been in study groups over 20 years, studying Walter Rodney, studying Chinese history, studying Asian contributions, studying Native American and indigenous contributions. Bolivia, with the Chavez redefining and re-looking at how it was, Venezuela was to look at the United States, Bolivian circles did it. Little groups of folks who organized, we're going to support Chavez, we're going to study and know our own history and understand our relationship to U.S. capitalism, imperialism, the big U.S. overseer up north. That's how they beat back the United States. And that's how the United States lost that Africa trying to pull a coup d'etat. Those study circles is who came together, because they knew and understood the history and the culture and the contribution, and they were able to move from it. So like I mentioned, I think with any of this, this is an opportunity for us to get it right, and let's hope we're able to, in 2006, eight, next year? Thank you, 2005, thank you.
Well, I'm the odd one of the bunch because I am not a history professor. That's all right. But I did have the pleasure of, do I have to do that? I did have the pleasure last year in the campaign to travel with Reverend Jackson for about 4 months on the political campaign. And I remember Election Day, we were here in Cleveland, started out here in Cleveland, hit the polls at 6 o'clock in the morning, and we had that sense of euphoria because we went to about 10 polling places with Mayor Campbell, longest lines in history, more people coming out to vote than anyone had ever seen, and such an excitement that you know, seemed to have been the case from 6 to 9 o'clock in the morning. Went to Cincinnati and the pouring rain, the same thing was the case. Came back here around 6, 7 o'clock that night, and the long lines were still there, but we said that's a good thing. Long lines were a good thing because it meant that people were coming out to the polls. Flew to Boston that night and had that about 3 hour span of euphoria when, you know, the first round of polls came out and said that we were leading, you know, nationwide. And it got very quiet a couple hours later. And I think that it has become very clear to all of us now that we did the work to get out the vote. We did the work to mobilize people to the polls. We did not do the work to count the vote. I think we, you know, as many of you know, there's a tremendous movement here in Ohio after the elections. But the main political parties, the main candidates were nowhere to be seen. Abandoned the effort to count the vote, and in reality abandoned the fight for democracy at its core. We won the elections in 2000 and 2004. We did not fight to count the vote and have our election victory validated. So what you were saying, you know, the morgue in office buildings around the country was not due to the fact that we did not win the elections, it was due to the fact that the elections again were stolen. And we have this tremendous political introspection going on around the country today. You know, what went wrong? Well, what went wrong really was that once again elections were stolen. And I think we have to come to grips with that. In this great land of democracy, elections can be stolen. And I think the means of stealing elections are becoming more sophisticated each and every cycle. It's something that we have to, you know, with poll taxes and disenfranchisement in very obvious forms in years past, it's highly technical in today's world. Now, that being said, I think that the main point that I want to make today is that the election reform movement is not a movement about technical reform. It's about political reform and political empowerment. And my sole purpose today is bring the Voting Rights Act reauthorization to the forefront of the movement here in Ohio and among those fighting for election reform. You know, the Voting Rights Act in 1965 was perhaps the most significant piece of legislation in our history, you know, coming out of the civil rights movement. It was not just civil rights for African Americans or people of color, but it expanded democracy for all America. And I think that's a very important point. Now, the Voting Rights Act comes up for reauthorization in 2007. If it is not reauthorized, it will fall by the wayside, and it will have a tremendous decimating effect for political empowerment, for voting rights, and for democracy in the country. It seems like, well, voting rights, that should be the easy one on the table today. But in fact, I think the Republican Party is scheming already to undermine the Voting Rights Act. This is the 40th anniversary. Selma was in March of this past year. The Voting Rights Act was signed in August of 1965 by Lyndon Baines Johnson. In Selma, the only two senators that appeared in Selma during the 40th anniversary of the march across Edmund Pettus Bridge were Senator Frist and Senator Allen, both of the Republican right. Not a single Democratic elected official outside of the members of the Congressional Black Caucus marched across the bridge and were present in any big way in Selma. Now, that's not just the scheduling issue or, you know, who showed up that day. The Republican Party put a lot of money into the Selma commemoration. And just as they were during the election campaign of of spreading money around into the black churches with faith-based initiatives and such, have taken that next step of moving money into the black belt. So in Selma, very clear to us is that through Senator Frist's offices and through Senator Allen's offices and through the Republican National Committee, money was flowing into the black belt. And their presence was highly visible. I don't know if you see the picture in New York Times, John Lewis and Senator Frist. Not a good picture. The second thing, and more importantly, I think, for us to understand is what the Republican strategy is behind the Voting Rights Act reauthorization. The Black Caucus met with President Bush a couple months ago. I asked him, do you support reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act? He said, initially, I don't support D.C. statehood. Well, push the wrong button, you know. That's not what we asked you. Do you support the Voting Rights Act reauthorization? He said, well, when it comes to my desk, I'll take a look at it. I don't know that much about it. Now, this is very disingenuous. This is a former governor of Texas, which is under the Voting Rights Act. He very, very, very much knows what the Voting Rights Act is all about. 2 weeks ago or so, a number of representatives from the legal organizations around the country met with Gonzalez and met with White House counsel, asked them about reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act. Attorney General Gonzalez's response was, I'm awaiting my instructions. I don't have a position. White House counsel was made a similar comment, but also expressed some reservations about Section 5. Now, here's where it comes down to the real guts of Republican strategy. And it's a Republican strategy that is unfolding very systematically without a Democratic strategy on the other side being advocated. Most people would say, and let me ask, just take a quick poll around the room here, should the Voting Rights Act be permanent? How many would say yes? Okay, about 100%. How many would say that it should be national? 100%. Okay. This is the trick behind the Republican strategy. To make the Voting Rights Act national or permanent would end the Voting Rights Act. Let me run that past you one more time. 100% of people in this room would say that the Voting Rights Act should be national and permanent. Within 1 year, there would be no Voting Rights Act because fundamentally it would be referred to the U.S. Supreme Court and would be automatically struck down as unconstitutional. So all around the country, Senator Frist and Senator Allen are going around talking to gatherings like this and saying, we need to make the Voting Rights Act national and permanent. And just like the response was in this room, yes, why do we have to come back, you know, from 1965 to 1982 and from 1982 to 2005 and keep reauthorizing this Voting Rights Act? It should be permanent. Well, because if you think back 1965, coming out of segregation, fighting the good fights of civil rights, the Voting Rights Act was what is called a narrowly tailored piece of legislation. And constitutionally, it has to come up for reauthorization because each time around, you have to prove that there's still discrimination and that you have to tailor a remedy based on that discrimination. So to say you want to make it permanent, while it sounds very good, would mean end it, because it would be referred to the Supreme Court immediately, and this Supreme Court would strike it down. Now you say, well, why shouldn't it be national? Well, in New Hampshire, you don't need the Voting Rights Act. In Texas, you do. In Alabama, you need the Voting Rights Act. In Iowa, you don't. So the Voting Rights Act is based on proving that discrimination in voting still occurs and that you need the Voting Rights Act and specific remedies as a solution. So my main point is this, is number one, within the voter reform movement, we must make the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act a central part of our agenda. Not to do that, I think, undercuts the political basis of voting rights in the country. It's not just D-bolds and DREs and paper trails. I think all of those are very important. But absent the primary fundamental political empowerment act of voting, the Voting Rights Act, I think some of those things will fall by the wayside or become shaded in their importance. The second thing, be careful about the language, because you're going to, the Republican strategy is very, very systematic. In fact, one of the leading African-American congresspersons from the South who is going to be responsible for carrying Voting Rights Act reauthorization legislation began talking about the need to make the Voting Rights Act permanent and national, because he didn't understand what it meant from a constitutional point of view. So our teams, you know, the legal teams and the civil rights teams, had to go and do brief. But this was one of the key people in the Congressional Black Caucus who started in his little stump speeches about the Voting Rights Act, started saying, yeah, we need to make it national and permanent. But he got fed directly from Frist and Allen. So Rainbow Push then is having a big march and rally in Atlanta on August 6th. I'd like all of you to consider forming mobilization committees in your respective cities and states. Lyndon Baines Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act in 1965 in August. So we're going to be organizing around the country, if not coming to Atlanta, to organize educational events and marches and rallies in your various cities around the country. The reauthorization language and a specific congressional bill will probably be introduced sometime between now and August. So the Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights and Rainbow Push and NAACP Legal Defense Fund and various folks in Washington have been talking over the past couple months about drafting the legislative language for reauthorization. So sometime between now and that time, a bill will most likely be introduced. So our strategy is one that we have employed over the years, that there will be a legislative component. We need to reauthorize a bill. And I think when the language is introduced, we'll be, you know, of course, gathering support for that specific piece of legislation. We'll be targeting different senators and congresspeople that need to be lobbied. It was last reauthorized in 1982, and a big effort had to be undertaken against the Reagan administration to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. And in this climate, with the Bush crowd, we can expect that same battle to go on. But the fight is not going to be won, in the most part, in the halls of Congress. It's going to be won out in the streets of America. We have to rebuild a political movement that demonstrates the people's will around the act and around voting rights in general. So hopefully our little march and rally in August is, as Mao used to say, single spark can start a prairie fire. So you know, we invite all of you to organize here in Ohio, either to organize local events or statewide events, or get on the bus. Meet you in Atlanta on August 6th. Okay.
Well, I must say, I feel somewhat humbled here. When I conceived of this workshop, I assembled a panel of people who I knew were teachers and historians and professionals in their fields, but because I had done a little bit of research and had engaged in a little bit of activism, I felt myself an equal, and yet I've been learning ever since the first words out of your mouths here, so thank you very much for that. There are a couple of points that we didn't quite touch on specifically, and are reminded of them by some of the things that you said. First of all, going back to the early democracies before the constitutional so-called democracy that was established in 1776, there were a couple of other models of democracies here on the North American continent besides the Iroquois Federation, and those most notably were formed by African Americans and Native Americans together when the African Americans escaped their captivity and ran into the shelters of the Native Americans and established their own. In fact, the first successful colony here on the North American continent was such a colony. And that really speaks to the issue of, where does democracy come from in our souls? You know, what is democracy part of our human nature? Is it a construct that we create just to meet certain needs? Is there a set of specific reasons why democracy is being denied us around the world in all of its various forms? And my own feeling is that democracy is what we as natural humans of all races in all parts of the world default to. It is part of our intellectual and social evolution that we gravitate toward natural forms of democracy when we are unimpeded, when we do not meet with external resistance. And when you look at the way the Constitution was written, the way it deliberately excluded so many people, when you look at the sum of the indices and pressures and circumstances that deny equal participation in whatever form of democracy we have, and especially when we look at the rigging of the elections in recent times, it should be noted that there are only two reasons why anyone would ever rig an election. And that is either to gain control of resources or to consolidate and perpetuate the power of those who are already in control. So in a very real sense, to corroborate what you were saying, is that this is essentially a class war rather than a race war. It is a social and economic conflict as well as a political one. And so our solutions need to be comprehensive and to take all of those into account. Which brings me up to, you talked about the poll tax and also about literacy tests as early obstacles and how they're being resurrected today in terms of economic factors like property values. Well, we also now have the passage of the Real ID Act. And I, as a, in my capacity as a journalist, had an opportunity to interview one of the principal authors of the Real ID Act and its various permutations in the state, starting with Arizona, moving then to Georgia and Arkansas and now Ohio. These attempts to require increasingly stringent standards for identification as a prerequisite for being able to vote will in fact have the effect of disenfranchising a great percentage of especially Latino, especially Native American, and also African American voters, because not everybody has the identification initially. Not everyone can afford to meet the fees, to come up with the fees to get the identification. Not everyone has that time, and not everybody has it within their culture. Native Americans who were born here, whose great-great-great-great ancestors were born here. Yes, Butch?
If I interject a little, Georgia passed a law that I think Evan's referring to that reduces the number of ID that are valid for voter registration and for voting from 18 to 5. And one of the provisions is if you go to a state school, you can use your student ID card as a valid form of identification. But if you go to Morehouse or Clark or Emory, your student ID card is not valid. Now, that's number one. Secondly, I think where it relates to the Voting Rights Act is that under the Voting Rights Act, the Attorney General's Office, the Justice Department, must what's called pre-clear this new law in order for it to take effect in Georgia. This is under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. This is one of the key provisions that we need to have reauthorized in 2007. So we've written to Gonzales, and we're going to start a campaign around this very soon, to have the Justice Department strike down Georgia's Real ID voting legislation. But this is where the Voting Rights Act comes hand in hand with some of these new restrictive laws coming down the pipe. But Section 5 is one of the key enforcement provisions of the Voting Rights Act that will come up for reauthorization. The other being Section 203, which are the language provisions, the bilingual ballot, the bilingual education materials, et cetera, on voting. So I think that's one of the tie-ins between some of the restrictive legislation coming down the pipe and the provisions of the Voting Rights Act.
And I'd just like to tag on to that. Earlier in the month of May, I believe around in the first 10 days of May, Senate Bill 3 and House Bill 3 were introduced into the Ohio General Assembly by Senators or Congresspeople DeWine and Coughlin. And in the legislation, it's online, you can look in the General Assembly website, the identification that's acceptable as proposed is not only your driver's license or state-issued ID, but a piece of government mail with your name and address on it. If something has been sent to you by the government, with your name and address on it, you bring that with you, and also utility bills. Now, if we like those provisions, we're going to have to lobby to make sure they stay in. All right, but that is what's proposed right now. The Ohio General Assembly, I find, is very responsive. Some members, especially these two, DeWine and Coughlin, are very responsive to the people if we make enough noise for them to act on our behalf. But I ask you all, please read the legislation. It's the bill itself, Senate Bill 3, is about 22 pages. It's not hard reading, and there's a summary of what the changes are available at the website for the Ohio General Assembly.
Excuse me, I have a question about that. Are you saying that this is instead of picture ID or in addition to picture ID?
Instead of. Because we have populations in Ohio, as Evan will tell you, we have populations in Ohio who do not obtain driver's licenses.
Right.
They don't drive cars. So using a piece of government-issued mail can be acceptable. Again, you have to look at that legislation and make sure that that provision stays in.
Of course, out west where you have a lot of Native American populations, there are a high percentage of people living on the reservations who do not have utilities, who have never had state-issued driver's licenses, who don't have much occasion actually to leave by vehicle, who don't have any of those ID requirements. And although a tribal ID is provisionally accepted in some cases as a form of ID, it also has to be corroborated with these additional forms, and so that's not good enough. And So this really will have the effect of disenfranchising a great number of people. And it's notable that there are no Latinos here in the room. There are no Latinos at the last two national voting rights teach-ins I've attended. That's one of the bridges that we have to build here, is to the Latino and Hispanic and Muslim communities as well, because there are great numbers of people there who will be adversely affected by these policies. And these are what I like to call newly emerging majorities. These are people whose voting power should be tremendous, and whose sense of justice as reflected by their votes, if they are properly informed and properly empowered and properly represented, will have a tremendous impact on the character of the democracy that we want to build. I myself have a sick feeling in my heart when I know that so many people are denied their ability to participate. I don't feel like my vote counts as much when I'm voting for people that I know don't represent other people who aren't able to vote. It's interesting that Japanese Americans similarly were not allowed to vote or actually enjoy the full rights of citizenship until the 1940s. You know, and once again, after the European invasion, it was 200 years again before women could vote. All of these voting rights have come about as the result of struggle. All of these voting rights are concessions that had to be fought for and won against an aristocracy bent on perpetuating its own dominance. And in a sense, when the country was founded, the so-called founding fathers, although they based the Constitution in a large part on the Iroquois model, with the restrictions and limitations that they included, clearly the whole intention of that was to preserve their power, was to build a new empire on this new soil. And those same elements are essentially the ones that are in power now, the inheritors of that particular legacy. We, in turn, are the inheritors of the sum of all of those struggles. You know, we are walking in the footsteps of Frederick Douglass, of the survivors of Attica, of the people who took over Alcatraz briefly. You know, we are the survivors and inheritors of the work of the suffragists of all stripes. And so as we continue that, we should recognize that there are new people for whom suffrage is still an issue. For instance, the nearly 4 million people who live in Puerto Rico, a U.S. protectorate, who are granted most of the rights of U.S. citizenship except the right to vote. The people who live in Washington, D.C., more than 500,000 of them, more than 60.1% of whom are African American and who are also denied the right to vote.
I apologize. I have to leave in a moment, but he made a good point, which I think is very fundamental to our discussion as well, is that our voting system in America is based on the state's rights system of voting. And it's part of the grand compromise of democracy and slavery, which I think is what we're really talking about. So that you can have, every state sets their own rules for elections. 50 separate state, unequal elections that take from California, Mississippi, Alabama. Every state sets their own rules for voting. So that, Congressman Jackson has a proposal to make voting a constitutional right, which I think will be coming forth in a period of time, to make voting part of the U.S. Constitution and shatter the state's rights system that still exists. And I apologize again, but Evan and Marcia. Yeah.